We're in Mark chapter 10. Mark chapter 10. You're experts because of the test. So what did we do in Mark chapter 9? What's been happening so far? Say it again.
Transfiguration.
Transfiguration, absolutely. The transfiguration occurred. Then what happened? The disciples were arguing over who is the greatest, probably because of what event that precipitated that conversation. Transfiguration and the inability to cast out the demon from the small boy. Absolutely. And that, you know, what we described about how the conversation probably went, where the inner three is probably like, well, if we were here, we would be able to cast out the demon. The other nine are saying, no, that's not it. It was just, you know, I was just off. We were just off today. You know, we just didn't have our collective morphing power or whatever they needed. Nevertheless, that was the issue. Then Jesus describes, he somewhat silences the who is the greatest debate by using what is an object lesson? Child. Why is that significant? Yeah, they were basically parasites on society. Outcasts of outcasts, especially if it was a female child. Especially if it was a female child. Which may have something to do with our discussion today on divorce, where I think another outcast of society is going to become the key center of the debate, and I think Jesus will answer the debate in the same way he does with children, and that's to give dignity to the outcast. We'll talk about that in a bit. After that, it led up to Jesus talking, John thinking that because they were the disciples, that he should rebuke anybody that's casting out demons in Jesus' name besides them. Jesus says, my word, you still don't get it. You still don't get it. And then Jesus describes his heart and zeal for his community by saying, if anyone causes one of these little ones, which could be either the children or the disciples, depending on who you think that reference pointing to, any one of these little ones causes them to sin, it'd be better for them to have a millstone tied to their neck and them thrown into the sea. Awesome. He's going to fight for his community. He's going to fight for his bride. Now we're in chapter 10. Kind of the way in which this is, chapter 10 is going to kick off three consecutive events, three consecutive scenes, all three of which I think highlight the disciples' misunderstanding of Jesus and his kingdom. We've been kind of playing through that already, have we not? We've had the two different sign acts, the one with the healing of the deaf mute in chapter 7. Then you had the healing of the two-stage miracle of the man that was blind, and that was in what chapter? Chapter 8, right? Chapter 8, 22. Do you see anything? People walking like trees. Do you see anything? Now I'm good. And we describe those as the literary function of them is describing the disciple's spiritual status. What they are not seeing. What they are not understanding about the kingdom. And we're going to see that that's still developing in the divorce section, and then in the section that follows with the little children, and in the section that follows with the rich young man. And the reason why is because in this divorce section, the disciples seem, in verse 10, they seem to opt for the view of the Pharisees. They're going, wow, the Pharisees' view seems to make more sense. Then, the very next scene right after that, with the scene with the children, the disciples are the ones that are trying to prevent the children from coming to Jesus. Then, after that, you have the rich young man, and the disciples in verse 26 seem to think that if the rich young man can't make it in, who can? Because he clearly is the one that's most exalted in society, otherwise he wouldn't be so rich. And these next three scenes are showing what we've already seen. The disciples are still really dull and just not getting the kingdom. But these three events for me are a lot more disturbing. Why? Why would these be more disturbing than what's happened before? Any ideas? Any thoughts? It probably has to do with context. So let me just give you a hint. Ooh. Why at this point would I become more and more disturbed?
Because it's later in the ministry. They've been with it for quite a while now. It's getting close to crucifixion or resurrection. They're going to have to take leadership pretty soon. They'll look at it.
Yeah. Jessica, I don't know if I could have said it any better myself. Absolutely. Absolutely. They've been with them for a while now. That's a bit frustrating. But after these events, we'll be 20 verses away from the triumphal entry. 20 verses away from when Jesus makes it to Jerusalem. And they show threefold, they still don't get it. That's bothersome. Because at Jerusalem, we will lead to the crucifixion, which will lead to the resurrection, and they will have to take leadership. So that troubles me a bit, does it not you? Anybody? Yeah, the narrative? You'd think that by this point when the crucifixion comes, Jesus is like, now I feel good to move on to the next realm because they get it. And yet even at the ascension we see in Acts chapter 1, they still don't get it. But he's got to go on sometime. And that's a ministry principle, I think, somewhere, don't you think? I'll let you do with that because we only have 40 minutes and we need to get through this. Okay. Jesus then left that place and went into the region of Judea and across the Jordan. Okay, what is that place? Where are they? Capernaum. In what region? First of all, where do I get that they're in Capernaum? Yes, chapter 9, verse 33. They came to Capernaum, right? That's their base of operations for their ministry, Capernaum. Not Nazareth, Capernaum. And Capernaum is in the region of Galilee. Now, this is very significant. More than likely what it says when they left that place, they go to the east side of the Jordan, cross it. Why would they do that? Because they're good kosher Jews. And they bypass Samaria, they would come down here and then enter into Judea. Does that mean that Jesus is rejecting the Samaritans? No. Why? Why? What would make me think that the Samaritans, you know, the half-breeds or Gentiles are good? Everything that's just happened the last two chapters, right? Syrophoenician woman, anyone? Clean and unclean issue? I don't think that he's doing that because, well, the Samaritans, they're no good anyway, we'll just bypass them. I think what he's doing is he's really walking with his audience. And his audience, being kosher Jews, would have been bypassing on their sojourn down to Jerusalem for the Passover. Does that make sense? So the interactions he's going to have with the Pharisees and a tons of other people will be happening on this typical Jewish sojourn across the Jordan and down over to Judea for the Passover. Man, there was something else I was going to say about that. Yeah, I don't know. We'll just keep going. Oh, no. That is important. From this point on, this is why... The reason why this verse is so significant is because Jesus will never enter back into Galilee again in the book of Mark. He's leaving Galilee and he will not return. Not in the Gospel of Mark at all. In Matthew's Gospel, he goes back there after the resurrection, but that's not in Mark's Gospel. So he'll never return. Very significant. From this point on, Jesus is in the Gospel of Mark, is shown on the road, on his way to Jerusalem. And you see this several different places over the next chapter. Chapter 10, verse 17, it says, as Jesus started on his way to where? Jerusalem. Chapter 10, verse 32, they were on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way. Chapter 10, verse 46, then they came to Jericho on their way to Jerusalem. Chapter 11, verse 1, as they approached Jerusalem and came to Bethpage and Bethany at the Mount of Olives. They're on their way to Jerusalem. Chapter 11, verse 11, it says, finally, Jesus entered Jerusalem. Now, if it wasn't for John's Gospel, we would not know that Jesus went to Jerusalem at all during his ministry before the time of the crucifixion. Because John's Gospel is the one that shows him going to the Passover multiple times. But Matthew and Mark, and I believe Luke as well, they all have Jesus going to Jerusalem once. And that's at the end. So, John actually fills in some gaps. Matter of fact, John's the reason why we understand Jesus' ministry was around 3 years. Because he has multiple Passovers. If it wasn't for that, we would think that maybe Jesus' ministry just all happened in a year and a half. Okay? Thanks for John. He does have some historical value, friends. Don't let the historical Jesus people tell you any different. Okay. Cross the Jordan, the trek, verse 1 still. Again, crowds of people came to him, and as was his custom, he taught them. So even as Jesus is leaving Galilee, this verse shows us that his ministry has not lost steam. If anything, his ministry is gaining momentum. Why? What's that? People are still coming to him. Why would it be gaining steam? Why would momentum be building?
Passover.
Passover. Why are all the people leaving Galilee, crossing the Jordan, and going down to Judea? For the Passover, which is an event that celebrates what? What?
The Passover.
What is the Passover celebrating? Oh, Old Testament history. What? The Exodus. The liberation from oppression. The liberation from bondage. The liberation from the empires that have been holding them in exile. And if someone with a kingdom message claiming to be the Messiah is making the trip to Jerusalem at the Passover, momentum is building. Right? It's going to happen now, they're thinking. It's one of the reasons why the triumphal entry probably even occurs at all. Because the one that's claiming to be the Messiah is now coming into Jerusalem on a donkey, not walking like everyone else, on a donkey. Inaugurating what we've been longing for the last however many hundreds or centuries before. The Exodus that we've been looking for. The new Exodus. The new Moses. So as if anything, his ministry is building in momentum, which naturally would lead to conflict. Verse 2. Some Pharisees came and tested him by asking. Now, the Pharisees, we've had, this will be their eighth conflict interaction with Jesus in the Gospel of Mark so far. Their eighth one. Very first one, Mark chapter 2, verse 16. Jesus, they say, why is he eating with sinners? I'm not understanding this. Why is he in there? I mean, because a true Messiah would not go hang out with sinners and tax collectors. Chapter 2, verse 24. Your disciples and you are picking the heads of grain on the Sabbath. You're harvesting. That's not kosher. That's not legal. Mark chapter 3, 1 through 6. They're healing the man with the... Jesus healing the man with the shriveled hand in the synagogue on the Sabbath. Conflict. Mark chapter 3, verses 20 through 30, which is what? It's a significant one. What? Yeah. The Beelzebub controversy. Conflict. That time they brought some big shots down from Jerusalem. The next time they do as well. Mark chapter 7, verses 1 through 23, the clean-unclean issue. Conflict. Mark chapter 8, verses 11 through 13, Pharisees and Sadducees demanding a sign from heaven. Conflict. Mark chapter 9, 14 through 29, the disciples' inability to exorcise a man's son. Conflict. This is the eighth time, and it's not the last. As a matter of fact, the conflicts will escalate, especially once we get into Jerusalem. And one of the first things that Jesus does is, oh, you know, let's just go and drive some people out of the temple. That will not be received very well. Some Pharisees came and tested him by asking, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? Okay. Today we're dealing with the divorce issue. And I'm in no way asking for testimonies, but I know it's an issue that's probably touched pretty much every single person's life in here in some way, shape, or form. Whether it's your parents, or maybe your siblings, or maybe if you're married, maybe it's your in-laws. It's pretty rare nowadays to find someone that has a family that has not been affected by divorce in any way, shape, or form. I believe out of the top five questions that you will be dealing with in ministry, three of them will have to do with revelation, which is one of the reasons why I think it should be required for all degrees, but whatever. Three of them will be about revelation. People want to know about the end of the world. And one of the other two will probably be about divorce. These are the main issues that that the rubber meets the road on. People will want to talk to you about divorce. Whether you're in counseling with somebody and they ask you, should I divorce my spouse? I don't know how many times in the first year and a half of ministry I was asked that question. And sometimes my answer was, yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah, we'll talk about that in a bit. I know some of you are freaking out. Am I for divorce? No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And neither is Jesus. But Jesus says that there are times whenever divorce is the right option too. Doesn't he? Doesn't Paul? I think so. Otherwise, I don't know what to do with 1 Corinthians 7. I don't know what to do when Jesus says, except for marital unfaithfulness. There are situations which divorce is legitimate. Nevertheless, even in a legitimate situation of divorce, it will still have wide-reaching ramifications that will be felt for generations. Therefore, it's never a decision that you flippantly walk into. And neither is marriage, by the way. You want to know how to prevent a lot of divorce? Start looking at people that are a mess for each other and saying, you should not be married at all to each other. You're bad for each other. If you don't have a community that's around you that won't look after you on the probably the second biggest decision you'll ever make in your life, your community is worthless. Just last spring, my wife and I had to sit down some people that mean a lot to us that were a month away from getting married and had to look at them and say, you guys get married, you'll be divorced in 2 years. You're a mess. Both of you guys are toxic for each other. One of the toughest conversations you can ever have. But I promise you, they can be mad at you at that time. But you'll be saving a marriage. It's okay to have people mad at you if it's the right thing and if you do it the right way and you're the right person. It's one of the things I looked at him and I just said, do you think I want to waste my time and energy on you being mad at me right now? Do you think I have something in this? Do you think that there's something I'm gaining out of telling you not to get married? Do you really think so? Because I'll be honest with you, it'd be way easier for me just to marry you and move on. Bottom line is, you guys are bad for each other. You're bad for the kingdom. You're going to be terrible partners in ministry. Not because as individuals you're bad. Individuals, you're great. But together, you're not good for each other. If you don't have a community that can stare you straight in the eyes and say that to you, if it needs to be said, you have a bad community. Bottom line is, sometimes you're so much in love that you don't see the major issues that are around you. I pray to God that you'll break up some other way if you're not supposed to be together. Do I think there's a right person for everyone? No, I don't. I don't believe in there one right person. You find your soulmate and I don't believe in that. At the same time, I don't believe you can just marry anyone. I think that's just as foolish. Because some of you just flat out together are not as good as you are apart. And that's okay to admit before you get married. Once you are married, I'm going to look at you and say, you need to figure out how to deal with it. You probably shouldn't have been married to begin with. But now that you are, now you got to figure out how to deal with it. And it's going to be hard. Very hard. So, divorce is an issue that I do take seriously. However, I do believe that the issue here is even bigger than what we reduce it down to in this text. What we're dealing with here, the question comes from, notice even how the question is phrased. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? What does he not ask?
Is it right?
He doesn't ask if it's right. That's true. What else does he not ask?
The woman can divorce.
Yeah, what is conveniently left out here? Is it lawful for a man to divorce a woman? Well, is it also lawful for a woman to divorce a man? To which they would respond, why in the world would she ever want to do that? She doesn't have that right. She's a piece of property. That's what she is in the eyes of the Jews at this point. She's a liability to the community. She's a parasite on the honor of the community. She contributes nothing of resourceful value except if she can birth a male child. I'm not saying that because I agree with them. I'm saying it because that's the way they saw it. Does that make sense? Therefore, their question, you have to read their question. They're not asking, is divorce okay? They're asking, is it lawful for a man to divorce a woman? And that may say something about the perspective through which they're even looking at women. And I think that's the issue Jesus is targeting here more than even the issue of divorce. This, though, is coming from an intra-Pharisaic debate. The Pharisees amongst themselves were arguing about this issue, and it was split up into two camps, one camp being the camp of Hillel, and one camp being the camp of Shammai. The two major Pharisaic camps on this debate. Now let me read the text they're debating before we actually talk about the sides. The debate that they are, or the text they are debating, the text in question, is Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 through 4. Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 through 4. Good old Moses. Moses says this: if a man marries a woman who becomes displeasing to him because he finds something indecent about her, we'll come back to that, and writes her a certificate of divorce, gives it to her, and sends her from his house, and if after she leaves his house, she becomes the wife of another man, and her second husband dislikes her and writes her a certificate of divorce, gives it to her and sends her from his house, or if he dies, then her first husband, who divorced her, is not allowed to marry her again after she has been defiled. That would be detestable in the eyes of the Lord. Do not bring sin upon the land the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance. Who is the one divorcing and being divorced in that context? The man is divorcing the woman, right? She's actually kind of bounced around like a ping pong ball. If he divorced her because, you know, something was displeasing, she goes to the second guy and he divorces her, well, the first guy can't marry her again, even though he may have said, wow, that piece of property was really handy. No, that's detestable to the eyes of God. In some sense, there is a protection of the woman there. She just can't keep being passed around from guy to guy to guy, and even the same guys. You take her for a while. Oh, okay, I'll take her for a while. Oh, okay. Some sense, Moses is protecting her. But the big key question, the big key debate is over the first line. If a man marries a woman who becomes displeasing to him because he finds something indecent about her. The two camps split on that phrase. Hillel comes along and the emphasis that he puts is on the word something. If he finds something indecent about her. Which could also be translated anything. Something or anything. And Hillel basically says that, yeah, it's pretty wide open of why you can divorce a woman. Matter of fact, in the Talmud, Gittin 9:10, he even says, if the woman burns your food, get rid of her. That is displeasing. That is indecent. That is something that she has done that has brought you shame. If she burns your food, it's okay for you to get rid of her. Divorce her. Akiba, sometime later at the beginning of the 2nd century, into the 1st century, would even say that if you could divorce a wife or your wife if you found a woman down the street that was better looking. Why? Because it's dishonorable for you to keep the ugly one. You should trade up. And that brings you more honor. That's the camp of Hillel. Awesome guys. Then the camp of Shammai. Shammai places the emphasis not on something, anything. He places the emphasis on the word indecent. What is indecent? That's the question he's asking. Not what is anything. What is indecent? And basically, Shammai comes down to basically saying the only thing that is justifiable to divorce your wife is sexual marital unfaithfulness. Sexual infidelity. He says, that's the definition of indecent. Other than that, sorry, you burn the toast, you need to just have her fix a new piece of toast. If she's not as pretty, you need to keep your heart in check. That's what Shammai would say. Now, there's key factors, once again, that we need to make sure we add into the question. That is the intra-Pharisaic debate that they're bringing up to Jesus. But behind this is two really key points. Number one, the woman does not have a voice in this conversation. The woman does not have a voice in this conversation. They are not a part of the debate. They don't get to have an advocate in the debate. They don't get a voice. Which I think will... number two, we need to keep this in mind as we're reading this context. This what Jesus' response will be. Number two, Jesus' answer is in regard to this issue alone. It is so tempting for us to think that what Jesus is doing here is developing this contextualist, in every situation, every moment, mandate or Magna Carta on divorce in these several verses. So that people will even say, since Jesus says, accept marital unfaithfulness, and that's the only thing he says, therefore, if a woman is being beaten repeatedly by her drunken husband, since Jesus didn't say drunken husband is a result of being able to be divorced too, then she has to stay there and just be a punching bag. People, I've had people say that to me. Well, I know that the only reason why I can get divorced is marital unfaithfulness, as the woman has a swollen black eye. And I'm going, yeah, I think you're turning Jesus into a legalist. I think his whole point is actually to protect the woman for not being a piece of property. And I think it may even extend to you getting beaten up. I do. As a matter of fact, in chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians, Paul says, another grounds for divorce is if you are married and then one of you becomes a Christian and the non-Christian eventually wants to leave you, let him go. It's okay to divorce him in that situation. Whoa, Paul, Jesus only said marital unfaithfulness is the only caveat from which we can divorce. Maybe it's not as black and white as we want it to be. Maybe every situation within the community needs to be dealt with on a case-by-case situation. There have been times whenever I've talked to a man and a woman, both different, where they were being verbally and emotionally abused by their spouse. And my response was, no, I think we can make it through this. I think we can make it through this. And I understand emotional and verbal abuse can almost be worse, a lot of the time, long term anyway, than physical. Although they're both pretty bad. I do think that I'm saying redemption is a part of this. So I'm not saying, hey, let's just find easy way out. What I'm saying is life's more complicated than what we try to make it. And we try to turn Jesus into a legalist where he literally only described the only scenario where divorce is legitimate. And I just don't think that we can pin him down because he's responding to a key situation with a key debate inside of a Pharisaic moment. And I think he's attacking something that's even bigger than the debate itself. Okay? You hear those caveats, my disclaimers, before we move on? I'm not asking if it makes you comfortable. I'm asking what's theologically most responsible. You guys awake? You here with me? Yes? Okay, let's move on. What did Jesus command you? He replied. They said, Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorce and send her away. Easy as that. Try a little certificate of divorce, send her off. Then Jesus says, let me actually describe to you why Moses did that first. It was because your hearts were hard that Moses wrote this law, Jesus replied. Not for your convenience. Not for you to get rid of a woman like a table that has a wobbly leg. It's not like you can just, I'll just write a divorce and just get rid of that piece of property. She's not worth much anything. We'll just go down to the market and find another one. It's not for your convenience that he wrote this law. It's because your hearts were hardened and full of rebellion that he wrote this law. So first of all, understand the contextual intent of Moses in this law. Then Jesus goes on and he says, but at the beginning of creation, what does he do? Yeah, he says, you're only going back to Moses, but let's go back to something that even supersedes Moses. Let's go back to creation itself. So I think that the issue of Moses is stopping short of the real issue, Jesus says. Let's get back to the real issue. But at the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. What text is he quoting? Genesis chapter 1, verse, you might know. I had memorized this like 7 times throughout my time at Ozark. 27, exactly right. Which says, in my notes, it's not there. Awesome. Yes it is. So God created man in his own image, and in the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. What text is he referring to? What is so significant about Genesis 1:27? What? The image of God has been imprinted upon male and female. I think what Jesus says right off the bat is, she is not a piece of property. She is made in the image of God. Did you forget that? You pass her around just like she's a broken chair. But she has the image of God imprinted on her just like you do, men. So you don't get to treat her flippantly. You don't get to treat her without dignity. Because when you do that, you literally are tarnishing the image of God that's been imprinted upon her. His first line of defense, number one, is you're misunderstanding Moses to begin with. Second thing is, and you're forgetting who it is that you're mistreating. Someone made in the image of God. For this reason, verse 7, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This text primarily is not talking about sex, although that's what we use it for all the time. Let me read to you where this comes from. This comes from Genesis chapter 2, verse 23. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. The emphasis on this is that the relationship that you have with this other person with the image of God is not the same relationship that I have with this desk here. It's not like, hey, you know, this is just a piece of property. I can do with it what I want. If it breaks, no big deal. We'll just buy a new one. He says, this is not the relationship. Instead, the relationship is like this. Whenever you're married and you become united, it's like one flesh. You treat her the same way you treat your own body. You treasure her. You protect her. You do whatever it is that she needs to provide for her. Because she is made in the image of God. Paul will later on describe to men the way we're supposed to treat women. He says, you love your wife the way that Christ loved the church. How did Christ love the church? He laid his life down for the church. He said, no, I will die for you. I'll protect you. I'll do whatever it takes. I will lay my own life down so that you may live. Why? Because the church, like women, are dignified. Because they're made in the image of God. They're not something you pass around. It's not a relationship like this. It is a relationship that can only be described as one flesh. One flesh. And you treat your you treat the woman the same way you treat your own body. See what he's getting to the heart? What's the heart that Jesus is going after? He's saying your question is plagued with wrong premises. Is it lawful for a man to divorce a woman? I don't like the way you're defining woman in that question, Jesus is saying. Why would it make sense that Jesus would be bringing this up? What's just come before this? Who is the greatest in the kingdom? All the men are arguing. And Jesus says, let me bring in a little child. And guess what follows this discussion on women and divorce? Little children coming to Jesus and the disciples keeping them away. Right? Jesus is saying what you guys define as outcasts, I see totally differently. And the key problem with the divorce question is that you're not dignifying women the way that God has by putting His image on them. And if you looked at them through the right lens, your question may be different. Do you know how many times in my marriage I've asked the question, is it lawful to divorce my wife? Try to guess how many times. None. It's just never come up. It's just never come up. Divorce, number one, is just not an option. My community took care of us before we got married. And that's just never, it literally, I promise you, it's literally never crossed my mind. Number one, it's because I do believe I do love her. But I also do believe it's because that we have been prepared to be together. That we weren't to just destroyed pieces that came together and just created a bigger mess. That happens, by the way. People think, oh, once we're married, we'll be, you know, whole. No. It's like you take a mess, and it becomes a bigger mess, not all of a sudden clean. You know what I mean? But I also, it's just, I just treat my wife with dignity. My wife and I are a team. Some people will ask, how do your wife and you deal with submission in your marriage? And I was like, wow, I'll be honest with you, that issue just never really comes up. Just doesn't. I've never once looked at my wife and just said, hey, you're the woman. I'm pulling the man card here. I've never said that. Why? I don't have to. We're a team. I know how messed up I am, and I need her perspective. Otherwise, man, I'll steer us right off a cliff. And there are times whenever I look at her, I just say, you need to pull the trigger on this. I don't know what to do. You pull it. And there's times where she's looked at me and said the same thing. We work as a team. And I think I've said this before, but I'll say it again. My key text for marriages, whenever I do marriages, whenever I marry people, is Mark 10:45. For the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give His life as a ransom for many. And if you walk into a marriage with that in your mind, that you've not come to be served, but to serve, your marriage will be fine. But if one of you walks into it saying, oh, you're serving me, hand and foot, you're serving me, you guys are going to have a lot of problems. If Jesus came down to the earth and said, I'm not going to be served, I'm going to serve, I'm going to wash your feet, I'm going to die on a cross for you. Tell me then, truly, what does authority look like? Tell me then, what does true submission look like? That's the problem here. The problem here isn't over the meticulousness of what it means to be divorced. The problem here is that they're refusing to look at women as people made in the image of God as the one flesh they need to protect. They'd rather just use her and abuse her for the ways that they want. And Jesus says, yeah, your premises is the problem, not the issue of divorce. Moving on, he says, so they are no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate. If God created both of them, and God truly has been the one that brought them together, I'm not understanding why the divorce question even needs to be asked. It just doesn't make any sense to me. When they were in the house again, the disciples asked Jesus about this. They're going, yeah, that doesn't seem to make much sense. In Matthew's gospel, they flat out just say, well, then who even can be married? And Jesus says, you're right, not everybody should be married. And that's something you need to wrestle with. If you at no point in your life have ever wrestled with the question, should I be single or should I get married? You're walking, if you think that, oh, I've got to be married. Really? I long for the day whenever our singles ministries or our churches is not Christian matchmaking. But it's actually a singles ministry where people that have called to be single are encouraging each other in their singleness and not looking for people that they can take out on a date. It's just not Christian. It's something we need to learn from the Catholics. Being single and celibate is a holy thing. Just as a good marriage is. I'd much rather you be single the rest of your life than to go into a marriage that's an absolute mess for you in the kingdom. Some of you have not called to be married. Some of you have been called by God to be single. And that's okay. You're not broken. You're not something that needs to be cured. It's a gift. And so treasure it. One of the worst things you can do whenever you're single is to constantly be looking for who you're going to marry. Just understand that your time as being single is a gift, and if God brings along somebody to be married, then He'll make it happen. It'll happen. But if you're not called to be married, be okay with that. Sometimes the way that I hear people talk to Doug Welch is like, so why are you single? Because God called me to be? Because God's not brought about somebody that I've said, yeah, I need to marry that person. It's not like He's got a disease we need to cure, folks, you know? I deeply respect Him for being single and still being faithful to God. It's not something that needs to be cured. Some of you have not made to be married and you shouldn't be. Some of you have and you need to be. Paul says both, you know? But the disciples are like, hey man, I don't get this at all. Well, of course not. We're only 20 verses away from the triumphal entry. He answered, anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another man, she commits adultery. He said, it goes both ways. If they're both dignified, they're both going to be judged by the same measurement. Just because I'm bringing dignity to women doesn't mean I give them the right to divorce whoever they want either. Both of them have to look at each other in the image of God and that there are two flesh becoming one. And what God has brought together, we should not separate. Because divorce causes messes. I've had somebody say, God wants me to be happy. I look at him and say, no, He doesn't. He's never said that. I'm not saying He's upset if you're happy, because that's just as foolish. But if you think, if you're going to justify your divorce because God wants you to be happy, you don't know God at all. You may have made a mistake that you were supposed to be single and been married, but guess what, pal? You're married now. Figure out how to do it. And one of the problems is the reason why people get divorced more than anything, well, there's two reasons. Number one, they're terrible communicators. And number two, they're too selfish. Those are the top two reasons why people get divorced. Bad communication. If you go 9 months and don't communicate with your wife, and sex is a part of communication, by the way. If you go 9 months and aren't communicating with your wife or husband, your marriage is going to be done pretty soon. Or if you can't get over your own selfishness, throw in the hat. It's over and it's your fault. Love you guys. See you in the morning.